Sorry, I thought the clicking the button was going to be our intro joke, but you didn't click the button, so.
I actually didn't. No, I didn't click the button, but I have now clicked both buttons, and we are now, in fact, recording.
You have too many buttons. You need to just get the one button.
It's a good number of buttons, Sean.
Okay.
Hi, Sean. How's it going? What have you been up to this week?
Well, so we finally have made like the Crates.io team an official proper thing. And I've been spending a lot of time working on growing that team, advertising it, running stuff. Ashley Williams and I are co-leading the team.
Cool.
We're 9 people now.
Wow, that's a far cry from you and Ashley solo sharing the pager and crying in your sleep when you get woken up in the middle of the night. I know that 2-person pager rotations are brutal.
It's still a 2-person pager rotation.
Okay, fair enough. But that can maybe change now, right?
Eventually, the main blocker there is, so we still want to have the 2-person pager rotation as like the who you escalate to. But basically, just there's a lot of things if we give full like production access, there's a lot of things that folks don't need access to deal with the sort of issues that we would get paged for. So we need to build a bot that lets us manage the site with fewer permissions before we can really start adding more people to on-call.
Gotcha. And so that's because you don't necessarily want to give everyone immediate full access to Heroku, because that's not really got much of an ACL on it, right? It's everything or nothing.
Yeah, exactly. And I figure the bot actually will probably just end up being like, it'll just subshell out to the Heroku CLI, and it's just right. Going to be an allow list of commands that we want to let them do. With, I guess, setting environment variables will be a little more complex than that too, because we will also want a separate allow list of like, and here's the configuration variables you're allowed to set.
Yeah, absolutely. But that's also like a really rich platform for you to do like more sort of high level operations, right?
So
if you find yourself running the same 5 to 7 sets of command against your bot every single time, that's a nice thing that you can just sort of whoop and abstract up into like a, hey bot, go fix the thing for me, rather than like restart this thing and do the other thing, right? Which seems like a really cool idea.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just a question of MVP versus what we would like to do with it in the longer term.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. How did you go about finding these people, and like what is their responsibility, or like what's the team trying to achieve that the two of you couldn't?
So there's a couple of different kind of groups of people in the team. So Ashley and I are there because, you know, operations. Then Carol and Justin are two people who aren't really that interested in dealing with the operational side of things, but they wrote a lot of the code, and they're the two other people who have commit access to the repo. And then we've got at least one person who is newer, who's just interested in getting more involved, but hasn't done so yet. And then several people are there because they're members of other teams, and we just want to increase the communication. So we've got 2 members of the cargo team and 1 member of the, well, and Steve, who's just, you know, good at communication. And Steve joined because we had an incident a few weeks ago, and it was very clear that like we needed somebody who was very good at getting all of the channels that we need to communicate in sync and organized. And Steve's good at that.
Yeah. I mean, it has literally been his job for a little while, so you would hope so. Because this was, and tell me if you don't want to talk about this, but this was like a bot uploading like every possible crate name in the universe, right, that wasn't captured.
Yeah, it wasn't like every possible name, but it was some dictionary list of like interesting file extensions and things that folks would want to take. And the main thing was that they were impersonating the crates.io team. The username was crates.io, and the readme said, if you would like to use this name, please open an issue on our issue tracker, pointing to the crates.io issue tracker. So that was sort of the issue.
Okay, gotcha. And how did you go about mitigating that? Did you just like track down all the things they uploaded and pull them? Did you block them at like some kind of upload or login endpoint? Like, what did you actually do to stop that from happening?
Sure. So we've got, if you go to the, we'll put a link in the show notes. We did a post-mortem and it's on the Rustlang blog, but basically once we got the report, we pretty quickly blocked their IP address so that they could no longer take any actions. And then we actually took a while before we took the crates down. We were very worried, like this seemed to be, I want to actually clarify a few things here. First of all, I'm speaking not on behalf of the crates.io team. I'm only talking about my personal opinions. Nobody should take anything that I'm saying here as an indication of how the rest of the team feels. And then second of all, we can't read minds, but we think that this was an escalation on a discussion that had been happening and getting very heated in the community about our name squatting policy. And so we were very worried during the incident about escalating things further. So we tried to be kind of very slow and make sure that we thought that any actions that we took weren't going to just result in further escalation and having them, you know, like turn this into a full on DDoS or just getting a bunch of friends to come also do the same thing. So we took smaller actions at first. So the community started noticing, and the reason they noticed was because we have two lists on our homepage of like newly uploaded crates and recently updated crates. So it's basically just, you know, sorted by created at and updated at descending. So one of the things that we did pretty quickly was just change the created at and updated at timestamps on everything they uploaded to a day ago to get them off the homepage, and then ban the user. And then eventually about 4 hours later, I think, we finally pulled the trigger and actually removed them. It's a very manual process to remove anything. Like the registry is meant to be immutable. So, and specifically getting things out of the index requires like somebody just go in and manually do it right now. And we may automate that. This shouldn't be a process that we resort to often. Like we very explicitly want to not resort to this if at all possible. So I don't know if we'll ever want to actually make removing a crate easy.
Yeah. And your index is maintaining GitHub, right? So it's like someone has to go in and basically do like a ginormous rebase to expunge things from it if you need to.
We wouldn't ever do it as a rebase. We don't need to remove like the history of what happened.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Unless I can't imagine any scenario in which we would remove the history of it specifically. Like even if it was a name that violated our code of conduct or something, I don't know that having the commit removing it is something that's harmful enough to justify rebasing it. But then again, we've never dealt with that situation. So I suppose that we would have to make that call if we ever have to deal with that.
Cool.
But yeah, so that was actually one of the things that we realized was, boy, it's a good thing that's happened during work hours in the US since, you know, the way we got notified was somebody reported it in the Discord and forwarded an email to help at crates.io. So one of like the short term things that we're going to do, and if anybody's interested in getting involved, if you happen to be awake during hours that America isn't awake, we're just getting an email address that we're giving out to the team and presumably a few volunteers as well who aren't on the team. That's just like the page us email address, and give that out to a handful of people that we trust to like monitor communication channels during those hours and use their judgment on, is this worth waking somebody up at 3 a.m. to deal with, as sort of like a nice catch-all for things that get reported that don't necessarily trigger any metric that would automatically page us.
Yeah, totally. That seems really good. So is there anything else that your new team is working on, or is it really just getting spun up at this point?
Well, it's mostly just growing it. So because of how heated a lot of these discussions have been getting, we've been trying to get more people to attend our team meetings as observers. Well, first of all, one of the things we're trying to get people to understand is you need to open an RFC if you want change to happen. You can't just like argue on a forum and then get mad that nothing happened from that. But number two, it's not just about whether you think something is a good thing to do or not. It's also about why is this important for us to do right now instead of all of the other things that we also need to do. And I think folks attending the meetings have really started to see, because we haven't gotten through the entire agenda for the last two meetings now. Yeah, it's just we have a ton of stuff that we need to get done and not enough people to do it all.
Gotcha. And is this like where you sort of have an established roadmap ahead of time? Presumably you already had like a sort of established roadmap of all the things you wanted to do, and now there are some more people getting involved and like they maybe want changes into that roadmap. And so sort of coaching them on the RFC process as opposed to just being like, I think we should do X, right? Like having a slightly more formal way of arguing for changes in that set.
Yeah, one of the things that we're actually going to formalize soon is what does or doesn't require an RFC to crates.io, because that's part of why we're going to have RFCs eventually happen on our own repo, not the main Rust RFCs repo, because we'll want to have different rules. Like, you don't need an RFC to request a new feature. You can just open a pull request if you're interested in implementing it.
Gotcha.
Or open an issue, in which case it may or may not get implemented. But, you know, things like policy changes definitely need an RFC.
So are you going to have an RFC for your what doesn't does not need an RFC?
Probably, yeah.
Excellent. Cool.
But yeah, anybody who's interested in getting involved, like, you don't have to attend our team meetings to get involved with crates.io, but you do have to attend the team meetings at least some of the time if you want to actually join the team, which joining the team is not a requirement for getting involved. But if you are interested in getting involved or joining the team, we have our meetings at 4 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays in our Discord channel, and anybody's free to join as an observer. And it's a really good way to sort of see what's going on and get a chance to weigh in on the stuff that we're dealing with right now. And I've actually been really pleased with the number of observers we've gotten. Yeah, the last two meetings, we've had almost as many observers as attendees, which is really nice, or as team attendees.
That's really cool.
Yeah, I'm hoping, you know, that we'll have folks like end up joining the team, because we need more folks on all aspects.
Yeah, this seems like a really well-developed and well-thought-out way to do like a bigger open-source project, right?
Yeah.
So like, is this like a standard Mozilla playbook? Is this something that like you and Ashley did intentionally? Are you copying stuff out of how Rust is organized? Because like, this is like a much more thoughtful design around a project like this than I think many open-source projects, which start with like a solo maintainer or a small group of maintainers for sure.
Yeah, it's definitely based off how other Rust teams do it. You know, we're trying to formalize a few more things. And basically, a lot of this comes from the community team, which is another team that Ashley leads. There's definitely, it requires a lot of thought, I think, for a project like this, because there are so many competing interests.
Right.
And crates.io is really important to Rust's continued existence. So having ways for us to get consensus is important, as well as just getting people focused on the things that we need to do and not have it be like, especially on policy issues.
Yeah.
We've got several right now that require actual lawyers that are rather important to get dealt with. And the, you know, the other thing too is it's very easy for these sort of discussions to end up eating an unreasonable amount of folks' time. So one of the reasons that we try to do this in synchronous meetings as well, as opposed to like just GitHub issues, is it also helps to limit. Number one means that we're more likely to get a majority of the team involved in the discussion. So consensus, you know, feels much more valid right. In that sense. But it also Absolutely. Limits the amount of time anybody to get involved in these policy discussions is required to commit to it.
Cool.
Because almost nobody on the team is on just one team. Almost every single member of the team like is also on other teams.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Not to mention day jobs.
Right. Exactly. Although, isn't it at least some people on that team's like day job to just do Rust things full time?
Well, yes, but like they have a lot of other Rust things that they have to do as well.
Right. Right, for sure. Do you ever see it being the case that it will be at least one person's full-time job to do crates.io full-time?
I mean, so I'm going to be working on it full-time for a couple of months.
Okay.
I guess I should probably mention to folks as well who are curious, I've left Shopify, so I'm taking a few months, so I'm going to be doing that full-time for a little bit. Long-term, no, I don't see it ever being anybody's full-time day job as a project that they work on it full-time and they're intending to work on it full-time for how, you know,
okay.
permanently.
Okay. Interesting.
Definitely, you know, it takes a non-trivial amount of time.
Yeah, I could totally see it being someone's full-time job, though, right? So, like, maintaining a web service, and there's probably, like, a laundry list of features that you're going to want to implement now and more in the future, and performance and maintenance and all of that stuff. It seems to me it's a thing that could end up being a full-time job for someone, for sure.
I think maybe eventually.
Yeah, maybe that's in the future, for sure.
I think if it was to be somebody's full-time job permanently, like the laundry list of features, yes, I do think that the nature of a package registry means that we kind of just do eventually get through all of the features, or at least yeah. all of the ones that are important enough to justify a full-time job. So it would have to be like that the operations and maintenance is taking up enough time to justify it, and maybe it'll get there. I think that requires our traffic growing by a couple orders of magnitude, though.
Sure.
If we need to get to the point where we have more that, you know, where we've had to introduce a bunch of other services to stay afloat and like yeah. that, there's just more stuff that needs to be done.
Yeah, for sure. Cool.
Yeah. I gave a talk about it at Rust Belt Rust a few weeks ago. I don't know. It's an interesting project. I'm excited to see it keep moving forward. It's been funny to me. This should be a miserable project to work on because it's got a ton of technical debt and it's using a bespoke web framework that was made to build crates.io and nobody else uses, and like testing is weird and somewhat painful, and so like there's so many things that should make this a miserable project to work on, but it's really not. It's a blast.
Oh,
so I'm excited to see it grow.
Is that because of the humans involved? Is that just because it's an important project? Like, why do you enjoy working on it so much?
Well, so yeah, a big part of it's because of the humans involved. When we had the incident, you know, it was nice, at least Ashley and Steve and I were the three who responded, and they're both very experienced and professional and just a pleasure to work with generally. So that makes the incident response a lot better. But yeah, the people, definitely a big part of it is just you don't have to worry about GC tuning or, you know, runtime shenanigans. We get to focus a lot more on things like tuning the database, which is really nice. So when you run into major technical debt or like a rat's nest in your code somewhere, sometimes it's really miserable, but I always think it's fun if it involves actually reading through like old commit messages and doing like an archaeological dig and getting in the person who wrote the code's head, which, you know, requires that like they're putting enough context in there. But I really enjoy like going and seeing what somebody was thinking several years ago, especially if what they were thinking at the time was particularly interesting. And so generally, when I run into these situations where I'm like, what is going on here? It tends to involve like a lot of archaeological digging. And I think that's a lot of fun.
Yeah, absolutely. That can be really, really cool.
But yeah, and then it's also a high impact project, which helps keep you motivated. So yes, all of those things.
Cool. So I had a really interesting discussion with somebody yesterday at DigitalOcean, and I wanted to hear your take on this as well. So I've been building a new, very small service that reads from our internal Kafka stream and like does stuff with it. We were talking about how to design the concurrency of consumers, right? So our Kafka has 6 partitions, which means you can have up to 6 consumers pulling information from it at the same time. And I was like, I'm just going to have 1 consumer per Go process, and then I'm going to use our internal Kubernetes runtime to like scale this. And like, that seems like fine. It's probably not the most efficient because of processes, but whatever. RAM is relatively cheap. CPU is relatively cheap.
Right.
And Kubernetes is a great abstraction for that exact scaling mechanism. And the other person I was talking to was like, oh, you should totally use goroutines to do this. And for the folks at home, a goroutine is like a super lightweight thread in the Go programming language. But in doing so, one of the things that you have to account for is like all of the possible errors that can occur between when the goroutine boots and it's actually listening to Kafka, right? And then of course, Go forces you to deal with those errors by like having error return values. And what I found is that what I actually ended up having to do to make this work is have like a channel of Go's error type that I have to pass into each of my Go routines. And then like in my main thread, like read errors out of this to check if any of these things failed, and then like have to work out what to do if like only one failed versus they all failed. And like, should I just immediately panic the program and restart? And I was finding myself like, this design was like adding an awful lot of complexity to my program. And this person is like a much stronger gopher than me and was like, it sure does seem like you're overly attached to processes as a concurrency mechanism. Is this because you're a Rubyist? And I was like, no, I just think it makes my program simpler. And yeah, I was kind of wondering what you thought about that.
Well, so I think it doesn't necessarily make things simpler, but I think that there's really, really good tooling out there for like, you have one process and you want to scale it to 6 and your process has crashed. Please try to restart it. Like, it's not so much that it's simpler, it's just like, it's just that it's handled for you already.
Right, exactly. And in Kubernetes in particular, right, the way it deals with this is it's not even that I'm running 6 processes within a single Docker instance, right? I'm literally running 6 Docker instances, and there's a health check endpoint on each one of them, right? And like, if that health check endpoint fails to respond for any reason, Kubernetes will just reschedule that thing. So like, and actually, this is also really helpful against the nature of Kafka, because like, if one of them is down for any reason, Kafka will just start sending traffic to one of the other consumers until like the group rebalances, right? And so like the concern that I had with my goroutine case is that one of my goroutines might die, but the rest of the process would keep running, and then I would be at degraded concurrency without knowing. Now, we've talked to death about process monitoring on this podcast, so I'm not so concerned about that. I found myself having to write lots more code as opposed to changing the number 1 to the number 6 in like a JSON manifest. And that's what triggered my like, is this actually like, is this additional lightweight concurrency actually helping me? And I don't think it was in this case.
Yeah, I think it's just a question of how big of a deal are the extra resources required to do the Kubernetes scaling. Like, is that a thing that you care about? Because if not, yeah, that's going to be simpler. I don't think that, like, Go routines are automatically a thing you should necessarily go for here, just because each of these consumers don't need to communicate with each other.
Right, exactly.
So it doesn't seem like you actually gain much by having them all live in the same process, other than it uses less resources.
Right, and I work for a cloud hosting provider, so
resources
are incredibly cheap.
Yeah.
Like, the least problem that we have is scaling our internal services, right? That's the easiest solved problem at DigitalOcean.
Well, it's also, you're not, like, talking about having to add hundreds or thousands of servers, it's six.
No, exactly. Well, and I mean, frankly, one of our internal Rails apps runs, like, 8x process concurrency, and each one asks for 4 gigs of RAM, right? So, like, and yet it does actually need all of that.
yeah.
And so, like, I think each of these Go containers is using 128 megabytes total RAM, right? So it's not even, it's tiny. The entire concurrency deployment here is less RAM usage than one pod of one of our Rails apps, which is kind of, like, hilarious to me.
So you could have all of these live on the same physical machine if you needed to.
Yes. So Kubernetes specifically won't do that, right? It will specifically spread them across machines on your behalf.
Oh, yeah. I guess you kind of want that for redundancy, don't you?
Yeah. So the Kubernetes scheduler is really, really intelligent. Like, we'll do things like make sure that you have your Docker processes running, like, very well spread out, and will reschedule them if something goes down, and it will also do rebalancing for you. So, like, your processes running on Kubernetes have to assume that they could be terminated at any point in time, because, like, what it's basically trying to do, right, is solve the box packing problem for Docker containers and some arbitrary amount of capacity that can run Docker, right?
What's the box packing problem?
That's a great question. So the box packing problem says that, like, I have things of varying sizes and a box of some maximum capacity, or so, like, several boxes of some maximum capacity. What's, like, the densest or, like, best packing that I can do, right? So, like, we want large gaps of contiguous RAM in case we need to schedule large services, right? So, like, if you have each individual server running on your fleet has 512 megabytes of RAM free, as opposed to one server having 8 gigabytes of RAM free, that changes what services you can and cannot stack in, right? And especially where you have Rails apps that need lots and lots of RAM to execute, you need to make sure that you have those big gaps available somewhere. And so what Kubernetes can do is, like, if an app comes in that it could theoretically fit in because there is enough space, but the space is not contiguous, it will effectively defrag your Docker services around until there are large continuous gaps.
Well, when you say contiguous, you just mean on the same machine, not, like, actually on a machine, like a contiguous block of physical memory.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's how it does that, right? I mean, virtual memory is an easy solved problem, but yes, it basically has to be on the same machine.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure that we're on the same page on that. Get it?
Yeah.
Get it? Page?
Yeah, yeah. I knew that. I literally heard the dad joke. But it's a really nice development environment to be able to work in, right? Regardless of this Go problem, I build a Docker image. That Docker image is the same everywhere. I play it into production, and it just kind of gets run and scheduled for me, which is just fantastic. And yeah, like, the folks who build Kubernetes clearly have put, like, a lot of work into making it really good. Yeah, it's nice. And yeah, like, basically, I'm actually still a big fan of process-based scaling, even in languages where doing threads are easy, if you don't need intercommunication, because it genuinely does just make writing your program simpler. I will say, one case recently where I've gotten a lot of leverage out of using Go routines is when I needed to scrape a lot of data out of, like, a web endpoint with different queries really, really fast. So I was just like, I'm going to make it so that there's concurrency here. And it was like, oh my God, this is now 100 times faster. Fantastic. And that, it's really great, right? You just basically say, go run this HTTP request, and then you have a wait group, and you wait for all of the requests to finish, and then boom, you have all of your results, and Go just, like, does it correct. Like, doing concurrency in Go is a genuine pleasure, actually. It's a really... takes a little while to get your head around it, because you have to do some programming with channels. And I guess for the folks at home, like, in Go, the way that you control concurrency is with this object called a channel. And a channel can has a type, so it can be like a channel of integers or strings or errors.
Oh, so this is a question I wanted to ask you earlier too, when you were talking about the error handling. So you cannot have a channel of two, like you can return multiple values. I know it's not tuples, but in my head, it's like it's a tuple, right? But I know you can return multiple values and go, you can't have a channel of multiple values.
No, but you could have like a channel of a struct, which contains multiple values, right? So yeah, and then you can send a value into a channel, but that will actually by default block until someone is ready to receive the value from the other end of the channel, right? So that can make doing the design a little hard because it means that you have to make sure that the typical pattern, right, is you spin off a bunch of goroutines, they all write stuff into this like one channel, and then your main thread will like read stuff out of the channel. To help with that and to improve performance, they do have like a buffered channel, which has like a maximum depth, which will typically be like 8 or 16. It's usually like the same as the number of cores that you have on your machine, and that tends to work quite well. But yeah, so like you can then get into situations where you need to solve race conditions across like channels and weight groups by having a goroutine which is doing the job of the thing you would usually do on your main thread. So you like spin off n goroutines and then like one like cleanup goroutine, and then like the main thread resumes executing, and it can turn into a little bit of a mess, but there are some good patterns that can be built out of this for sure. Doing parallel map in Go is really easy.
So you mentioned that there is a buffered or an unbuffered blocking channel and a buffered non-blocking channel. Is there a infinite buffer non-blocking channel?
Not that I'm aware of, okay. And they explicitly don't want you to do this because it means that you could have no receiver, right?
Right. Well, and you also just potentially have unbounded memory growth. If you do have a receiver, just not one that can keep up.
Yeah. There are lots of reasons why that might not be a very good idea.
Yes, I agree. I was just curious if it existed. I'm just comparing. So Rust also has some basic channels in its standard library. Although for the sort of thing that you're talking about, it reminds me of the library Rayon, where just you replace dot iter with dot par iter, and now your map is parallel across however many cores your machine has, which is really cool. Although it'll be using real threads, not green threads, so it's potentially a little more expensive.
Yeah, and also there's like your objects have to be send to be able to do that, right?
Sure, but I mean, if you want to do this in parallel, yeah, it has to be a thing that is safe to send across threads. It's more just Rust is enforcing that in the type system.
Right. Well, it's really interesting. In Go, there are some things built into the standard library that just magically work across Go routines. So for example, so in Go, there's like the standard library, and then there's what's called the experimental standard library. So it's like Golang X is like the package namespace. In X, there's now a thing called the rate limiter, which implements a token bucket based rate limiting algorithm. And that struct, actually, you just make one of them, and then you can share it across arbitrary Go routines. So say you want to be absolutely sure that I'm making no more than 10 HTTP requests per second to like this domain across regardless of how many Go routines, they can all just have a reference to that thing, and it will sort of magically work. It does locking and stuff internally. Also, I'm playing with a plushie Ferris.
Aren't those so cute?
So the way the token bucket works, right, is it basically, it's a really old school computer science construct. You say I have a bucket and it has k tokens in it, and they get replenished every n seconds, right? So one token gets added every n seconds, and so that's how you implement like 10 requests per second limiting, is like you add one token every 0.1 seconds.
Well, it's also nice too because you can have the bucket size be larger than the number of requests you want them to make in 1 second to allow for bursts, small bursts of traffic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's really cool. What's nice here is that the Go interface to this, it kind of abstracts over a lot of that complexity. You just describe those two things and it does it for you, which is, I will say, as a language that is trying to implement complex distributed systems, they've spent a lot of time making sure that they have good primitives for implementing complex distributed systems in the language.
Yeah, that is just interesting to me. That's not something I would expect to ever be in a language's standard library. Like, it's a really useful thing to have as just a library that's well designed. It's just, you know, I guess Go has much more of a like kitchen sink design to its standard library.
Well, so it's actually more extreme than that. They're really trying to provide so much in the standard library that adding third-party dependencies is like strongly against the norm. And so like the basic philosophy when I talk to gophers is that if you have the capability to do it within the standard library, even if it isn't in the nicest or cleanest way, you should do it and not bring in a third-party dependency to make your life easier, because they really want it to be really clean and pure in that sense. And so that's why the Go standard library is absolutely huge.
Right.
It has routines for generating SMTP and MIME frames in it. I think it implements both an SSH client and an SSH server. The standard library of the language is truly massive, right?
Yeah. So rate limiting is a thing that I'm actively working on right now.
Uh-huh.
Actually, I haven't looked that hard, but I don't believe there's a library already out there that has like an implementation of Leaky Bucket. But so right now I'm just like, can we just do this in Nginx? And the answer is, as long as the only thing we're rate limiting on is something that Nginx has access to, so like IP address instead of authentication token,
sure,
then that's fine. Although it turns out that getting the IP address in the right place for Nginx to know about it takes a little bit of work, and compiling it with the real IP module so that you can tell it, like, here's how you figure out what the IP address is in the X forwarded for header,
yep.
Which, you know, everybody has opinions about what the right way to do it is. They do the same thing that Rails does, where you just give it the allow list of like the proxies that you trust, and then it just gives you the last IP in that header that comes before a trusted proxy. I know Django does it differently. Cool. They just say you expect N proxies, and it doesn't check the IP addresses of them.
Yeah, but so
anyway, sorry. This is a tangent.
I mean, this is totally something that you could implement, though, right? You could just go ahead and grab Google's implementation, which I'm sure is like as robust as you could possibly imagine, and port it to Rust. That might actually be like a fun little project for anyone out there who's listening, is implement a token bucket rate limiter and upload it to crates.io.
I mean, that would definitely be a useful thing. We need it for crates.io. Yeah. So we're just going to keep it in Nginx for now, because like same reason as process-based parallelism, right? There are tools that do it for us that are well built. I guess actually one other difference too, both for what you're talking about earlier with Kubernetes and also this, tools that are well built that also aren't specific to any language, which is nice.
Yeah, I think we have our episode title. Tools that are well built will do it for us.
I like it. But yeah, it's nice. We will eventually need to do something that involves potentially hitting the database for rate limiting. So having an implementation kind of built for us would be really nice.
Yeah, for sure.
Should we wrap up?
Yeah, absolutely.
Show notes for this episode can be found at yakshave.fm/9.
As always, ratings and reviews on iTunes are appreciated.
If you have feedback on this episode or any of our other episodes, you can email us at hosts@yakshave.fm, tweet us @_yakshave, or leave a comment on the website.
Thanks for listening to The Yak Shave, and we'll see you next time.